edge of ecology.
Hi, it's Friday, the 17th of April, 2015. This is Peter Bourne of The Information, and I've just got to Burgess Hill, a little bit late, about 8:15, for Marcus Allen's talk about the moon landings and his latest information about if it was faked or if we haven't been told the full story. I'm just walking down the road to the venue, which is on the outskirts of Burgess Hill, a small east, or is it West Sussex town? Yeah, it is West Sussex, I think. On my left here is the Potter's Pub, where we often go after the event for a talk with the speaker. And the others who attend have been going on at this venue for over 20 years now, incredibly, and I've been coming for, well, getting on for that time, amazingly, with a few gaps in between.
To the mailing list sheet at the back there. And now I will shut up. So Marcus, he comes along here, as many of us have for years. It's our 24th year in here, by the way. And you hear Marcus every now and then interject with something interesting. And so it's time to give him the whole floor again. He is renowned not just for being the UK publisher of Nexus magazine, which he is, but also for being one of the key questioners of the moon landings, which is what we're going to hear about tonight. And also, he talks on lost technology in Egypt and all sorts of things. So, he's not just a one-trick pony. He really is very respected. He is really hated by many people and will be in prison soon, which is why we would need him here tonight. Marcus raises questions and plays devil's advocate in a great way that we need more of. And so, we're going to hear tonight what the latest evidence is about the moon landing. So please, Marcus Allen.
Wow, something to live up to there, isn't it? Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much for being here. Because it's a nice evening, and there may be better things to do, but when we finish, you may decide that this was the best use of your time tonight. Andy's already introduced the subject of conspiracy theories.
Be very careful.
I was invited to speak at an astronomy group up in north of London, St Albans, in February, and this was how they introduced me on their website. So I thought, okay, that's where they're coming from. I think we can deal with that.
Shall I turn the slides up, Marcus?
Yeah.
Which one? Are you happy like that?
Is that better?
Yeah, that's better.
No, that's better. We can read it now.
There we go.
So they decided that this was how I was going to be introduced, which is fine, I don't mind. As Andy's already said, I was interviewed by Jeremy Clarkson on the Clarkson Show when he had a talk show. I didn't drive any cars. And he wanted to talk about the moon landing. This was a few years ago. He heard me being interviewed on the Steve Wright Show, and he invited me on to his, and it was great fun, great fun. He's a very professional interviewer. He's a very good television personality as well. And because he doesn't like America very much, he was definitely keen on getting somebody along to talk about something which might embarrass them. And I was very happy to go along with this. Because the Apollo moon landings are a subject which people have, in some ways, quite strong opinions about. Now, there are three positions you could hold on the moon landings. A, they all happened exactly the way NASA told us they happened. Two, it happened mainly the way NASA said, but there were one or two things which maybe they got slightly wrong and they covered it up a little bit. And the third position, and you can probably tell this is the position I may well be coming from, they never got anywhere near the moon at all. How can I say that when the world's leading magazine, the National Geographic, in December 1969, published probably one of the most iconic photographs of the 20th century, Man on the Moon. National Geographic know about photographs, don't they? That's their stock in trade. They wouldn't publish a fake photograph, would they? But of course they wouldn't. The photograph isn't fake. Now we've got to go back a little bit to understand a little bit of the context of the Apollo program. This is April the 21st, 1961. A week after Yuri Gagarin allegedly was the first man to orbit the Earth. And I say allegedly because he wasn't the first. first man was Vladimir Ilyushin, the son of the aircraft designer, who was top test pilot in the Soviet Union. I'm going to refer to them as Russians rather than the Soviets, because we all understand where they're coming from. Russia is, well, people understand where Yuri Gagarin comes from. Vladimir Ilyushin was launched a week before Gagarin. He orbited the Earth three times. We know this because some two Italian brothers were listening in to all the transmissions from near Turin. And they're recording it. There's nothing secret about it. The recordings were available. Reader's Digest did a big article about it. Vladimir Ilyushin landed in China. He wasn't meant to. The retro rockets didn't fire at the right time, and he came down rather badly. He was very badly injured. The Chinese looked after him, got him better, returned him to Russia, and when Gagarin did his world tour, meeting world leaders, the Pope, the Queen, the Kings, Princes, all the rest of them, the Chinese were conspicuous by their absence at every diplomatic reception that was organized. 6 weeks after Gagarin did his leap, apparent flight, John Kennedy here makes his famous announcement, we will land a man on the moon before the decay is on, return safely to the Earth. This is at the Houses of Congress. And behind him is Lyndon Johnson and Earl Warren, who would figure quite prominently in the Warren Commission report into Kennedy's assassination. Well, he concluded, with no apparent evidence, that it was the result, he was shot by the result of a lone gunman, Lee Harvey Oswald. The fact that he couldn't have done it, and he's put a lot on, and there's a lot of evidence to show that he didn't do it. Lyndon Johnson would take over from Kennedy when he was assassinated about 2.5 years later, and would institute a lot of the space program, bearing in mind Johnson was senator for Texas, and outside Houston is now the Johnson Space Center, named after him because of all the money he got from Congress to support the Russian, the American space program. This is the context of the Apollo program, the space race, the confrontations over Cuba, Kennedy being assassinated, the Vietnam War, which is very unpleasant. There were student riots, there were city riots. Robert Kennedy, John Kennedy's brother, Martin Luther King were both assassinated, all within the 1960s. This is the time of Apollo. There wasn't much good news in America. America needed a bit of light relief. So they were going to get a bit of light relief from the Apollo program. And then we're going to go to the moon. This is wonderful. We know where it is. You can look out in the sky at night, you can see it. It's not that far away compared to somewhere like Mars or Venus or any of the other places. 250,000 miles away, give or take two. And the Apollo 11 landed about here. And this is more or less the equator of the moon and center. This is the Copernicus crater. We're going to see that again later. And there's another crater down here, which we're also going to have a look at later, because there's some interesting information that comes from it. Now, getting to the moon isn't a problem. It is not that difficult. You get a big enough rocket, and you fire it up, and you can get it to the moon. The real problem is getting back again. The Russians got to the moon in 1959. The Americans got several unmanned craft there. That isn't difficult, and there's no question about it. What's really hard is getting people back, and craft to an extent, because if you're going to go to the moon, there are three things you're going to need, or four possibly. The fourth one is you're going to need to take a nice camera with you, so you can take lots and lots of pictures, so you can all look at them and say, oh, this is wonderful, take them on the moon. This is the Hasselblad camera. And when I was interviewed for the Discovery Channel on this subject about 10 years ago, they borrowed this replica from Hasselblad, and I got a photograph of it. A couple of points to look at on here. These are the batteries that drive the motor drive that winds the film forward. That is the only automatic function on the camera. There are levers on the side here which set the shutter speed, the aperture setting and the focus rates. Now if you are used to digital cameras, this is all going to sound very prehistoric. But this is what they used. They did not use digital equipment. It's a very good camera. I've used a similar camera. And they are very, very good. They're good because the lenses are very good. They're very strong. They were built by Victor Hasselblad for the Swedish Air Force in the early 1940s for aerial photography. It was never really designed to be carried around. So if you carry it around, you've got to carry it like this. This is just to show a particular point which we're going to come back to later. If I'm taking a photograph, and this is taking a photograph with my camera at this position, i.e. chest height. If I take it at head height, where most people would take a photograph, this is what you will get. You'll be looking down on the camera, and specifically this is exaggerated, but the horizon will be relatively high compared to the horizon here. Now I know that's quite close, but it exaggerated, and it does make the point that the higher the camera, the higher will be the relative position of the horizon behind the subject. This is how they worked out their exposure. They had a little chart on the camera, which I couldn't actually see from inside their spacesuit anyway, but that's a minor point. If they had the sun at a particular point, they set the aperture at a particular level. Now most people are familiar with point-and-shoot cameras. You switch it on and you point it and you shoot, and that's it. You get a nice picture. Not with this, you didn't. Now, inside the camera they have this screen of 25 crosses, they're called reticules, and they appear on all the lunar surface photographs. Now in order to go to the moon, bear in mind they're going to spend about 8 years preparing, they're going to practice a little bit. So what they're going to do is they build a nice globe. They've already sent unmanned craft to the moon to photograph what it looks like. So they've got the photographs here, and now they're creating an image of what the moon looks like. It's not, no secret, no problem. You'd expect that, because what you will do here on the camera track, this is a film camera track, you'll mount a camera and you will move the camera towards the surface, in this case the moon, and you will then project it outside the simulator window, so that as you simulate and practice your landing of the lunar lander, you'll see the moon outside the window. But it's already been filmed. Nothing secret, no problem there. It's what you'd expect to happen. They're very accurate models. They're quite big models. There's two people there. It's about 30 foot square. It created some of the craters on the moon. Again, there's no problem with this, because you'd expect them to make the most accurate simulation of what you expect to find on the moon. They even built one of the biggest gantries in the world at Langley, which is where the Central Intelligence Agency have their headquarters, so that you could practice landing your lander by removing 5/6 of its weight, so it would appear to be landing under lunar gravity. It's still there now. You can go and see it if you can get past the CIA guard. You can see it on Google Earth actually as well. Now, if you're going to go to the moon, I say you need three things. One of them is this, a whacking great rocket. Huge, great thing. High for St. Paul's Cathedral, I think. Weighs 3,000 tons. Most of it is the fuel. And off it goes. The amount of power generated by the Saturn V rocket is equivalent to the amount of electricity consumed in Britain. 60 gigawatts of energy. It's a very powerful piece of kit. It'll fly up into the sky, and when it gets to about 40 miles up, the first stage will just fall away because it's used all its fuel. It'll go on for another 50 or 60 miles, and the second stage will fall away because it's used all its fuel up. Then it will go into Earth orbit. It's about 120 miles up, which isn't quite high enough, so the third stage has to put it into a higher orbit, where it will orbit the Earth, and then it will fire its rocket again, and head off to the moon. That's how we're told it worked. Now, if you're going to put men in there, they're the men in there, in that top little triangle there. That little spike on top is the escape rocket. If the whole thing went belly up, they could get the astronauts away by firing the escape rocket and they would land somewhere else. I don't know how they would do it fast enough, because if this thing exploded, you wouldn't want to be anywhere near it. Anyway, they have a nice little escape rocket. So off they go into space. When they've been going for 2 minutes, they're out of sight and we can't see them. The next time we see them for real is when they splash down at the end of their parachutes. Big parachutes, so between launch and splashdown, there's only one source of information, NASA. They're the only people who is providing information. There's no independent corroboration of any of what we're going to see now. We've got to take NASA's word for it. Never a straight answer. National Academy of Space Actors. So, in order to get to the moon, they've got to go into space. Well, what is the temperature of space? The answer is
absolutely zero.
-273 Kelvin. Very, very cold. The coldest temperature here on Earth is about -80 centigrade Kelvin in Antarctica and in Siberia. Humans can just about survive that for about 5 minutes. In space, is way below that, so you've got to be protected. So astronauts have to have something to protect them. They've got to have spacecraft, spacesuits. They've got to have something so that they can then survive. Because in space, it's a vacuum. There's no pressure. Currently, we sit under 14.7 pounds per square inch of atmospheric pressure. We don't feel it because we're used to it. If you put your hand out of a car window doing 60 miles an hour, you'll feel the atmosphere. It's quite heavy. So the vacuum of space, you have to overcome that. So you've got to carry your own atmosphere with you. The space suits were pressurized to about 5 pounds per square inch. And the worst part of going into space is this stuff, radiation. Whoops. Radiation generated by the sun, solar particle events, solar flares, or galactic cosmic rays from outer space, nasty stuff. Do you any good if you get hit by it? These are solar flares here. They're quite normal. But if one of these goes off, and Earth would be, in terms of comparison, Earth would be about the size of that laser pointer tip. Quite small relative to the sun. So this is big. This is huge. Several hundred thousand miles across. So if that explodes, which they do quite regularly, and it explodes towards Earth, like here, we're going to be in trouble. Occasionally that does happen. In 1989, there was a major blackout in North America, which was caused by power grids shorting out as a result of a solar flare. We are protected here on Earth by two things, or two belts of radiation protection. Created and held in place by the Earth's magnetic field. It's the Earth's magnetic field. They're called the Van Allen radiation belts, named after Professor James Van Allen, who first identified them by putting a Geiger counter on Explorer 1, the first American satellite. You put the Geiger counter on it, it fired it up, and the Geiger counter stopped working. So the phenomenon. And then they found out the reason it stopped working was because it was overloaded. It wasn't calibrated to read the level of radiation it had encountered. So when they put the second one on Explorer 3, again it stopped working when it went into the area of the Van Allen belts, which is about 500 to 1,000 miles. They started about 500 to 1,000 miles. When it came down again, it started working. It had just been overloaded. So these are belts of quite severe radiation levels. As NASA has finally admitted, as a result of the Orion craft, which we'll see later, they have stated that the levels of radiation in space are severe. So how did all the Apollo astronauts survive? And NASA went on to that one. Right, so head off to the moon. Lovely picture, isn't it? Earthrise. Ah, great, love these things. Iconic picture. It's a double exposure, by the way. Picture of Earth here. Picture of probably the model of the moon that they built, because, alright, here's one for the mathematicians. If you're in orbit around the moon, you'll be about 60 miles above the surface. If you're in orbit around Earth, you're 200 miles up. So how far away is the horizon from your viewpoint in the orbiting spacecraft? The answer is 250 miles. So the horizon is 250 miles away. Now, it's no atmosphere to make it look a bit blurry, as it does on Earth. But would you honestly see that amount of detail in the horizon? The highest mountain on the moon is Mount Hadley, 13,500 feet. That's not it. So it's a smaller mountain. Are we expected to believe that that is the detail that you could see at 200 miles? I know the cameras were good, but I don't think they were that good. Now you're going to fly to the moon, you're going to have yourself your spacecraft, and you're going to land it, or you're going to land the lunar lander, the name, the purpose is in the name. This is the control panel here, that in the case of Apollo 11, which we'll see quite a few pictures of, Neil Armstrong was using to fly the craft manually. Remember, they had the computer overload, the 1202 alarm, and they said, right, let's go, you can land, you do it yourself. And he almost ran out of fuel. That wasn't it exciting? A great piece of script writing. Okay, here's the question. You're in this rather flimsy little craft here, on your way to land on the moon. Are you wearing your spacesuit? Logically, you would expect to. But if you're wearing your spacesuit, you can't wear half a spacesuit, you've got to wear the whole kit, the head, helmet, the gloves, boots, the lot, everything. Would you, if your life depended on it, wear heavy-duty gardening gloves to control and operate these switches? I don't think so. Would you operate a computer, if your life depended on it, wearing heavy gloves? No, you wouldn't. You'd do it like this. This is taken during the simulation exercises. They did lots of them. They did real-time simulations. Apollo 11 was an 8-day mission. It's an 8-day simulation. Logical. Now, you've probably heard the famous video, you keep hearing about it, as they land on the moon, kicking up some dust, 7 feet down, and it's Buzz Aldrin whose voice you hear. Armstrong's far too busy trying to work out what to do to land with him. So you're hearing his voice. How can you hear his voice? There's a rocket, 10,000 pound of thrust rocket, 3 foot below him. Oh, they're wearing their spacesuit, of course you can hear him speak. But would you control these panels here wearing a spacesuit? I don't think so. But they did. They obviously did. They must have done, because they've now landed on the moon. Neil Armstrong has done his one small step for man, one giant leap, etc. And he's down there, and he's got his camera, and he's photographing Buzz Aldrin, who's coming down about 20 minutes later. The TV camera that filmed Neil Armstrong coming down is about here. They then move it and put it on a tripod, and it then films them for the rest of the time. Here is Buzz Aldrin coming down the ladder. The timing is quite important here. Then he comes a little bit further out onto the porch, and don't forget this is a completely different photograph from the first one. And you can see that it's all beautifully lit here. And it's in shadow, by the way, this side of the lander, because there's the illuminated surface of the moon there, directly illuminated by the sun. But it's very well lit here, isn't it? Beautifully. Oh, what did you say? Of course it's the sunlight reflected off the lunar surface. You have to know a little bit about the ability of Copenhagen. Prepper firm, which is what he was using, to record detail in shadow and highlight without using additional light, which is why most cameras have flashbacks.
So they can provide additional light.
Alright, at this point, Neil Armstrong has got bored and he's going to photograph the rubbish bag that he chucked out before he got down himself. You can't send Americans anywhere without leaving rubbish. He then photographs a foot pad because they have to see if it's been damaged. I don't know what difference it would make if it was damaged, but if it was damaged and he couldn't take off, well, he's been stuck there for a lifetime. But he takes a nice picture of one of the landing pads there, and then, he's done much further down the ladder, we'll take another picture of it. New aperture setting, new focus, but it's still all well composed. Why is this blue? Well, that is a personal story. And then he's a bit further down the ladder, and he's well illuminated here, isn't he? And you can see everything, every little detail on his spacesuit. You can see the American flag at the top. You can see inside the porch here. This is, it just tells you exactly what you're, you don't even need a caption. This is a great photograph. He's a bit further down the ladder here. He's got still well illuminated. And now he's going to be standing right at the bottom of the ladder, about to get off and do his one small step, etc. Now, those previous eight photographs were all taken in sequence. And those will be reference numbers. You can go and check them out on the NASA website, nasa.gov, history, Apollo 11. Coming out there. And in the time I've been speaking, is the time he took to take them, 3 minutes. Now, there's no problem in taking eight photographs in 3 minutes, even if you're going to refocus it and set apertures and all the rest of it. But without being able to see where the shutter button is, you can't see it from inside your space loop, without hearing if the camera has taken the photograph, because there's no mirror, because there's no viewfinder, how do you know you've taken a photograph? And you still get all these extremely good, they are very good photographs. If you go on the NASA website, this is what you'll find. And these are the ones we've just looked at. Coming out the ladder, that's fine. There they are, in sequence. And there's my photographs, another of the pads there. Going back to this one here, as you come down the ladder, there's something very odd about this photograph. Very odd indeed. His foot is not on the ladder. His foot is not on the ladder. Now, if you are up a ladder cleaning windows, for instance, and you want to come down, you're about 10, 12 foot up in the air, would you really come down kicking your left foot out if your other foot is not even on the ladder? Health and safety be after you in a flash. It's ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. And we're expected to believe he's on the moon. Come on, guys, he's not on the moon. It's probably Houston, but it could be California, where they have another set which they put together to practice doing this. And this is, so it could be Buzz Aldrin, we don't know, we can't see his face. And he's probably done it 100 times, and he's now going to come down and say, look, guys, you know, let me just try dancing down the ladder and see if it works better. I mean, come on, this is not taken on the moon, this is taken out of control, studio lighting conditions here on Earth. And if anybody can prove that is not correct, I want to hear it. Where did these highlights come from on his heel? They can only come from a point source of light, on a curved surface. A highlight will only be a point source of light. Look how much detail there is here, in effect, in the shadow. We'll see other photographs where you can't even see the ladder, because it doesn't, you don't need to. Oh, great, this is wonderful, isn't it? This is so good. This is Buzz Aldrin, really showing how well he was practicing. You take your Hasselblad camera, you point it at your foot, and you take one photograph. beautifully composed, accurately exposed. Man on the moon. Used all over the place. Control 3D lighting conditions here on Earth. There's no way you can take a Hasselblad camera, point it at your foot, take one photograph and get it absolutely spot on exposure, aperture, focus. You'd take lots of them, but you're not quite sure if you've got the thing pointing in the right direction. You wouldn't take one, and you would bracket it. Bracket is a technique used by photographers. You get what you think is the correct exposure, and you expose slightly higher and slightly lower. You take maybe three photographs, different exposures of the same subject. You wouldn't just take one. But he did. Now we have a mystery in this picture. Oh, by the way, look how dark the ladder is suddenly. You can hardly see it. Just in silhouette. It's the same ladder he's just come down. And we have a mystery here. We have the one-legged astronaut. Where is the footprint going in the other direction? I don't know. Right. Two astronauts on the surface of the moon at the same time. That's fine. There's no occasion where it's not fine, but this time it's fine. These pictures were taken from a data acquisition camera, which is a cine camera mounted inside the lunar lander, taking one frame per second for the whole time they're relatively on the lunar surface. Here you have two astronauts, Aldrin allegedly, Armstrong allegedly. I say allegedly because we don't know. NASA tell us who they are, and we'll have a look and see if we can find a photograph of Neil Armstrong on the lunar surface. They're both about the same height. An astronaut couldn't be higher than, couldn't be taller than 5'10". So why is this shadow 50% longer than this shadow? And the ground is level here. They're not standing in a crater. It's level. So if you go back to the previous picture here, this is the piece of ground that you're looking at. It's bumpy, but it's not seriously uneven. And yet, the shadows are different lengths. These are the angles the shadows make. This is 25 degrees, this is 35 degrees. But the sun is at 13 degrees, we're told, and they landed. So, this wasn't taken on the moon. It's an anomaly, it's an inconsistency. Here we have, allegedly, Buzz Aldrin. Do you know why he's called Buzz, by the way? It's because his sister, younger sister, couldn't pronounce the word brother when she was referring to him. She could only say Buzz. And that's why Buzz Lightyear is called Buzz Lightyear, because Buzz Lightyear is named after Buzz Aldrin. And it's only because his sister couldn't make it the same word. So here is, we'll call him Buzz Aldrin, shall we? Isn't it nice? So what's all this? What are these things? Oh, that's camera flare, we're told. Hasselblads don't flare like that. There's a Hasselblad camera flare. They have a six-sided lens, six-sided shutter inside the lens. So what's this? What are these things? They are again. And why are we looking down on his top of his helmet, the top of his backpack? If the camera which took the picture is allegedly on the chest of Aldrin, of Armstrong, who took the picture. Here we have another iconic photograph. It's from the Almirante on Apollo 13, Apollo 11. Because there are only 121 pictures taken on the lunar surface on Apollo 11. And this is one of them. And there's the photographer. And there's the flag. And that's the lunar wind experiment. So that's the huge ballerina. And this is him. And where's all this light coming from? It's illuminating his dark shadow side. The surface of the moon does not have sufficient reflectivity to reflect the amount of light into this area for then to be photographed by a camera. It's been reflected twice, once off the surface and once off the suit. Light doesn't work that way. Yes, the moon is reflected. That's why you can see it at night when it's reflecting sunlight. That's the photograph that you're more familiar with the black bit at the top.
but it's not strictly true. This is the original taken off the NASA website, high-resolution original. It's about the only photograph where you look quite at the composition spot on. But isn't it wonderfully done that you've got the horizon and the reflection and the horizon in the background exactly the same angle and point? It's so cleverly done. Better than I am at doing it. We know what a camera was, actually. We know what the lens is. It's a 60mm Biogon lens. Excuse the technology, but it's a wide-angle lens on a medium-format camera, which is what this is. So if it's a medium-format camera under very bright sunlight conditions, which is what this is, allegedly, how come the background's out of focus? Which it is. This little rock thing here is out of focus. It shouldn't be out of focus when taken with a wide-angle lens. It would have taken with a telephoto lens under controlled studio lighting conditions, because this shouldn't be falling off. The light should not be falling off towards the back. If it's either by sunlight, sunlight is powerful enough to light, in this case, about 2 miles away, whatever the horizon is, in one go. Ah, here's Neil Armstrong. This is the only photograph that people will acknowledge that is of Neil Armstrong on the lunar surface. Wow! Isn't he looking to get publicity? No. That previous photograph here was taken here. There's the rock in the background, which is suddenly, from a camera further away, a little bit more in focus. It's as if it's been taken with a wide-angle lens again. The photographer who did most of these, his name is Michael Tuttle. You see when his name appears on quite a lot of photographs on the NASA website. He doesn't deny that he put them up on the website. So here's Neil Armstrong, not very well illuminated, is he, suddenly, compared to Buzz Aldrin. Now, look at the flag. Remember the one of Buzz Aldrin saluting the flag? It was a completely different position. Remember I mentioned about where the horizon is relative to the subject? The higher the camera position, the higher the relative position of the horizon will be. You're looking down on Neil Armstrong, if that is it. So taken from about 8 to 10 foot up in the air. Now, coming back to the rubbish bag for a minute, these weren't there originally. They are now. Anybody have any idea what they are? Because I don't know what they are. They look like a rather 19 ladies' evening handbag or something. But they're lying there, nobody's ever identified them. They're in the original photographs. And here is one of the lander pads with no dust in it at all. None whatsoever, not a speck. But Buzz Aldrin says, as they land, the lunar lander kicking up some dust, so where's it all gone? Oh, it's a vacuum, the scientists will tell you. The dust will just get kicked up and then come straight down again. You get some in there, because when they landed on Mars and they took a picture of the lander's pads, yes, you see dust in the pads. Okay, Apollo 11. These are two consecutive photographs taken by either Neil Armstrong or Buzz Aldrin, nobody knows who, at exactly the same time to the nearest second. Look on the Lunar Surface Journal, Apollo Lunar Surface Journal, every piece of speech, everything ever said by anybody, every photograph taken is identified to the nearest second. And these were taken at the same time. You can't do that because these moved position. Whoever took the photograph has moved. This is supposedly Earth. I say supposedly because it's identical to the Earth we looked at on the way to the moon. Now, how do you take that photograph? With great difficulty is the answer. You have to lean back so far you're likely to fall over. It's quite hard to hold, assuming the camera's on the chest, you're leaning right back, you've got to angle the camera at the subject, i.e. the Earth,
You've got to stop shaking, and you've got to press the button you can't see. I don't think that's how it works. We know that's the position, the height of the Earth above the surface, 66 degrees, so you've got to lean quite a long way back. 45 degrees leaning back is quite an achievement. 50 degrees, you're going to fall over. So this is either a double exposure, which is more likely, or it's a mock-up, and I hope nobody will ever work it out. Another couple of consecutive photographs. One on the right here, moves slightly further forward towards the lander here. But what is the flag doing above the horizon? And the camera, the TV camera on this tripod, above the horizon, there it is then. The solar wind experiment, it's considerably higher, it doesn't make sense. The horizon is also different. This is almost completely flat, and this isn't. They're not, you have to move that much closer. It doesn't have a zoom lens. It's as if these were taken by completely different conditions using a model. Here are our heroes, Buzz Aldrin, Neil Armstrong. This was taken from a book purchased at the Kennedy Space Center. Astronaut Edwin Aldrin inside the lunar module after his moonwalk. No, it's not. If you look at the sequence of photographs where this comes from, he's halfway to the moon. He's not after his moonwalk. It's a lie. Neil Armstrong, inside the lunar module, as it rested on the moon's surface. Well, it may be, but it's more likely to have been Neil Armstrong in the simulator having done 8 days hard labour, because the photograph is taken with a flash gun. And you can tell it's taken with a flash gun because there's a highlight of light in each of his eyes and on his teeth, which is an artifact of using a flash gun. You get a highlight of light in the eye. Look at any paparazzi photograph. Any well-taken press photograph will have that. There's nothing unusual about it. It's very unusual on the moon, but it doesn't have a flash gun. Moving on to Apollo 12. Al Bean coming down the ladder. He's quite well illuminated too, but not quite so well illuminated as Buzz Aldrin was, and then when you look at the photograph in a bit more detail, you see it's been completely manipulated, very badly airbrushed. The artifact of airbrushing a photograph, you can have bits left behind. Again, on Apollo 12, an 8 photograph sequence, 2 photographs to start with, both rather boring. And then an astronaut, and then 2 more rather boring photos, and then the same astronaut again, from a different angle, and 2 more boring ones. Very clever to be able to photograph somebody using a camera on your chest, looking down on him. There's the guy who allegedly took the photograph, isn't it lovely? No, right, they managed to do it again here, straight through the reflection. But you're looking down on the camera with a camera that is supposed to be at the same height as that camera. These were rigid mounts, they weren't floppy stuff. And you can see the top of his pack here. What's all this? There's the Hasselblad shutter lens. But what are these things? And why is this all a bit murky? Because they forgot to tone down the background lighting. There's the camera mounted on here, and his arm is coming across, holding the pistol grip. What's this? I don't know. Looking at the other photograph, suddenly there he is, you're looking straight into the camera here, or very nearly straight into the camera, and he's in a completely different position. The photographer is supposedly the same person, using the same camera, but but he's got a whole load of stuff going on here which I haven't a clue what that is. Are they spaceships or are they reflections or I don't know. And then when you look in detail at the detail of the first photograph, you'll find that there are two crosshairs here which shouldn't be there. There's a double exposure. It's been manipulated. And then when you see the sunlight, the strange angle of the sunlight, when you have a photographer here with the sun behind him, who's casting the shadow forward, you would expect the shadow of, this is the Surveyor 3 craft which was landed on the lunar surface about 2 years earlier, you'd expect the shadow to be more or less in the same direction, but it's not. Why? But it's a model. And they forgot to light it properly. As is this one. There's the Surveyor 3 craft again, close up, and there it is at the distance. That's Intrepid, that's the Apollo lander. But look at this crater. The crater here and the crater there, the same crater. Perspective doesn't work that way. But if you're using models, and you sometimes get perspective wrong, this is the result you'll get. We come on to Apollo 14. I haven't mentioned Apollo 13 because it's a bit boring, and I didn't bring the one thing that they didn't have with them, which was the Haynes Workshop Repair Manual for Apollo 13. Very useful, very useful. They should have taken it. The problem with Apollo 13 is that was a complete fabrication, because if you have an explosion on a spacecraft, it will go off in the direction opposite to where the explosion came from. Newton's law of motion. You get an explosion, which is what happens when you fire a rocket, start the thing, the thing goes up. If you get the explosion in your oxygen tank, which is what happened on Apollo 13, where it fell, it'll go off in a completely different direction. But it didn't. Doesn't make sense. A lot of Apollo 13 doesn't make sense, including Tom Hanks's film on it. Okay, Apollo 14. The sun. This is the sun. Very clever being able to photograph looking directly into the sun using film. But it's so weird, it's completely altered the crosshair. Well, you shouldn't do that. The film is behind the crosshair. It's as if they've been, they were trying to put them on later and they didn't get them in the right position. All four of them are distorted. Why are they distorted? Shouldn't be distorted. Okay, Apollo 14 from a different position, Intrepid, and I'm just going to flip this over. For very good reason, look at the American flag here. Look at where it is. And look at the position of it in relation to the stars here, top right, and the stripes. Here's the golf shot, taken from Alan Shepard's biography called Moonshot, because he took the golf club onto the moon and whacked a golf ball with it. There's the golf ball, and there's Alan Shepard, and there's Ed Mitchell, and there's the golf club. And there's the American flag. Hang on a minute, it was the other way around. And it was much closer. What's going on? It's a fabricated photograph. This was a photograph about this size was on display in the Kennedy Space Center for many years. Because Alan Shepard was rather proud of his golf shot, apparently. Until it was pointed out to him that it's a composite. And it can be demonstrated to be a composite because we've already seen there's the lander. There's the lander there. The checkerboard thing, I don't know what it is, but it's at the bottom of the ladder. And when you get it here, see it there as well. And the flag's been moved, and the shadows have been put in, and he's been taken from another picture, and he's been taken from another picture, and they have put the golf ball in as well. But it's a photograph, it's not a video still. There is a crosshair there. There's the video still. We used to got the flag around the right way. So it's a fabricated photograph, and NASA just didn't admit to it. Put a montage, technically.
Marcus, could you take a picture of a golf shot and guarantee to get the ball in the shot?
Of course. If you you watch golf, if you've got any golf on television, yes, you can see the golf ball coming towards you, but you won't see it doing that. I don't know what speed golf balls fly at, but it's much too fast to be able to photograph it. So it's a fabricated photograph. On Apollo 15, I mentioned the highest mountain on the lunar surface, which is, this is Mount Hadley, which is Mount Hadley Delta, which is very slightly lower. And this is the Apollo 15 landing site. They had the Rill, which is this sort of collapsed volcanic tube. Give me a break. Volcanic tubes aren't a mile wide, is what this is. Okay, there's the landing site. And looking from that, past the landing site, towards Mount Hadley Delta, this is what you see. It's about 5 to 6 miles away from landing point, landing site here. And you've got a lot of lovely detail in the foreground here, and you've got a beautifully set up photograph. This is this any photographer would be very proud of this photograph with four major components, an astronaut, a flag, a lander, and a rover. So that your eye travels from left to right as it should do, and then it travels up the back here, but you don't then say, why is the background so much more ridiculous than the foreground, and there's no atmosphere if it's taken on the moon, because this is an artifact of front projection, front screen projection. What you've got here is a screen onto which picture is being reflected. If you take a photograph of that picture, it will be a little bit darker, a little bit weaker than the original photograph, because it's been reflected. And this is what they were doing. They were using big screens to reflect the background. You can see the detail, the quite clear division between the 3D foreground, where the actors are, and the background, which is just to show you when you're on the moon and there are a few mountains nearby. This is Mount Everest. This is Mount Everest Base Camp. And the height between Base Camp and Everest is about the same as that photograph is supposed to be, about 10,000 feet difference. Base Camp, Everest Base Camp is at 19,000 feet, Everest is 29,000 feet, that will be there. And it's about 7 miles away from Base Camp. I'm told I've been there with the climb. But this is what you expect to see. This is quite normal, this is quite legitimate. This is, this looks like Snowden's weather system. Tiny little pinnacle, not a 10,000 foot high mountain. Here we have another mystery. Dave Scott and James Owen. Dave Scott, it pleased Dave Scott because he's the commander and he has the little red flash on his helmet. And this is James Owen. Dave Scott, photographed by Jim Owen. Fair enough. They're consecutive photographs. I double checked that. And this is James Owen photographed by Dave Scott. How? He hasn't got a camera. James Owen hasn't got a camera when he took this photograph. So how do you do it? I don't know. It's an anomaly. This is the leaping limb. This is photograph here, that is the same piece of the mountain. There's a little nodule. Oh, it is over here now. And there's two of them. Very weird. Apollo 16, we have a bit of a mystery with the lunar rover. This is the lunar rover being mounted onto the lunar lander at Houston. No, at Florida. Florida is the vehicle assembly building. And it's being mounted, as you can see, on the right-hand side. There's the ladder. There's the ladder. It's obviously being mounted on the right-hand side. It's got port and starboard there because it's a ship, and if you look out towards the bow of the ship, port is on your left, starboard is on your right. There are the windows there that they'll be looking out of. There's the door they will be coming out of, and there's the ladder down which they will walk. So what is this lunar rover, which is this thing here, doing what it appears to be taken out from that side. NASA won't answer the question, which side is it? It doesn't matter which side is mounted on, at least get the story correct, get the continuity right. Okay, now we'll move on to Apollo 17, because if there's any astronomers here, I have a question. There's the Apollo command module of Apollo 17. It's been photographed by the lunar lander, which is separated, and then flies higher in order to land two orbits later. This is where they're going to land, and these are about 6 miles wide. The valley's about 6 miles wide. So this is the question. There's the previous photograph we just looked at, and this is a similar photograph from Apollo 11. On Apollo 11, you get a terminator. The terminator is the, we call it dusk on Earth. It's the bit between darkness and light. On any circular body, you will get a terminator. So where is it on here? You can see how long the shadows are. The shadows are quite deep here. This is Mare Imbrium, which is flat. But where's the terminator? You wouldn't see that far away. Taken from the same sort of position, Apollo 11 is showing an obvious terminator. I don't know what the answer is. It's an anomaly. Unexplained detail. Oh dear. Oh dear. Harrison Smith here on Apollo 17. And the American flag, obviously. And yeah. One photograph. Could you get... And I tried this. Get two people like that, it doesn't have to be a flag, it can be two people, and line it up with the moon, in our case, because you can't line it up with the Earth, because we're on it. Could you do that? You probably say you could, yeah. Could you do it without a viewfinder? A bit more difficult. Could you get the exposure and aperture right? Tricky, that one. Could you do it in one photograph? That's all they do, one photograph. This photograph here is just an examination to show that it's actually a triple exposure, or triple image. So NASA never ceased to amaze me and surprise me. And once you start knowing what to look for, it becomes quite easy. Okay, this is Apollo 17. This is, we're on one side of the valley, and there's the other side. That's just a phase in the image. It's not anybody else. It's just to demonstrate one thing. When you examine that photograph under extreme contrast, you get what appears to be the artifact of a screen. Now, there's a lot of stories about Stanley Kubrick and his possible involvement in the Apollo photographs. I don't personally think he was involved, because he would have made a much better job of it if he had been. He was a perfectionist. He possibly might have been consulted. He knew what he was doing, because when he filmed Dr. Strangelove in 1962, he asked the American Air Force if he could borrow a B-52 bomber, as you do. And they said, no way. But he said, well, could I just have a look inside, so at least I'll get the detail right, because I want to fly one of these bombers over Russia so we can drop a bomb on them. No, you can't. So he went away and read all the right magazines, and came back. Pinewood Studios, where he filmed it, and constructed the B-52 bomber. To the extent the American Air Force then demanded to know which one he'd actually used, because it was so lifelike. So Stanley Kubrick was a perfectionist. He would have made a much better job of these photographs. Okay. In this photograph here is the lunar lander. Can you spot it? Probably not. But it is there. It is in that photograph. It's there. It's about 3 miles away. You probably wouldn't see much of an object 12 to 5 3 miles away. That's quite logical. There it is. And if you start getting closer to it, you'll see it is the lunar lander. So it's quite a long way away, and it's, the mountains are pretty big behind it. So how is this photograph, or these three photographs, explainable? There's the lander, there. All these
adjective on each photograph, this little light coloured mound. So basically it's looking in the same direction. If you were standing by the lunar lander here, you wouldn't get that mound in that detail. Anybody who's taken a photograph would know that. So what's this doing? And what's this doing? That's the mound. Same mound. It's like they move it around. It jumps around, as we'll see. Jumping around, there it is. That's the lunar lander. And here it is, oh here. Same objects in the background. Mountain in the background. Who moved it? Is it a model, possibly? And they just didn't get the scale and the perspective correct. There's the lander. Where is it? When the lander landed, it stayed where it was put. It didn't move around. But it moves around here all over the place. But it shouldn't. Now, how did they manage to put this little tripod thing? It's supposed to have a colour chart on it so they can calibrate photographs. Nice idea, however ridiculous, because once they've taken the photograph, you couldn't actually do much with it. They managed to put the rover in place with no tracks in front or behind it. Plenty of footprints, so we know that it would be evident if it had moved, but it appears, why did they just lifted it up? How could they do it? And again, you've got this rather poor quality background, and the foreground is very detailed. Another picture of the rover with no track at all. Plenty of footprints. You've got some dust on the wheel, so we know it must have gone around. Well, they're very proud of their repair of the mudguard. I don't know how they broke it off originally, apparently they did. But if you look in detail at this little area here, it's almost as if the clamp that's being used isn't attached to anything. Except to the map, it's a map. But I show this photograph mainly because there's no evidence of tracks of the moon rover. So are we looking at fact or are we looking at fiction? We're probably looking at a little bit of both. Let's talk about the Russians here. This is the Sobhai Korolev, the chief designer, the genius behind the Soviet space program. From his start up until the time he died very suddenly after a quite routine operation. There's nothing mysterious about it. He just died early 1966. From that time on, the Russian space program really didn't progress very well. This is Yuri Gagarin. You can see here the damage to his left eyebrow. It's supposed to have occurred when he jumped from a first floor balcony after attacking a nurse in a hospital. He was never the same again, and his body has never been found. He was crashed in a routine training flight. He's an astronaut, he was in a routine training flight with an instructor, and he crashes the aircraft, and I can't find his body. I find his jacket, but I can't find the body. So I've wanted to get rid of him. He was becoming alcoholic, you can see how puffy his face is, he was not a well man. This is only 7 years after his death, after his flight. Okay, the moon rocks. Plenty of moon rocks here. And we know they've come from the moon, don't we? Because if you go to the Science Museum, you can look in the exhibit there, on the Apollo 10, command module, and there's a piece of moon rock, more like this one, piece of moon rock. We know it's a piece of moon rock in the Science Museum because it says moon rock. And the Science Museum wouldn't make a mistake, would they? 90 countries can't account for the piece of moon rock that they were sent by NASA. 10 American states can't account for the moon rock that they were sent by the president. If you go online, you can probably buy it. It'd be worth about $500,000, I reckon. Right, the reflectors. This is the usually the fallback position where most people will say, well, of course they went to the moon because they put the reflectors there and they now fire giant lasers at the moon and it reflects back and we tell how far away the moon is.
Why did they bother? National Geographic in 1966 had a long article about the magic laser being bounced off the moon 3 years before Apollo even got anywhere near the place. Bouncing a laser off the moon isn't a problem. Pointing pointed at the moon, it'll bounce back. Not much will come back. Not many photons of light will come back. Somewhere if you've got a big enough receiver for it. So putting reflectors on the moon is not going to demonstrate that man has put them there. The Russians put two up there on the lunar garden. Unmanned craft, which are still up there and are still reflecting. So how do we know which one they point their lasers at? When you fire a jam laser at the moon, how wide will it be when it gets there? The answer is about 2 miles. So if it's 2 miles wide when it gets to the moon, how wide is it when it gets back to Earth? About 12 miles. So that's why you need a big collector to get all the this was from the Rijksmuseum. The Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, which came under a major renovation a few years ago, and they moved one of the exhibits, and this is one that they moved. The moon rock presented, with the compliments of the Ambassador of the United States, to commemorate the visit to the Netherlands of the Apollo 11 astronauts. So that's obviously what it is. So why is it petrified wood? Which is what it is. Now, Rijksmuseum, the Dutch have got a great sense of humour, and they said, oh, this is wonderful. We're going to examine it now. It's not worth much. So did somebody swap it for the original? Would they notice if they had it? It's very sad. Nothing about Apollo goes well. Even this. This is a more recent photograph taken from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter of the Apollo missions on the moon. And you can tell where they are because NASA very kindly put a giant arrow pointing directly at a little bit of shadow. That's nice something. Going back to Apollo 12 here, this is the Surveyor craft, which is almost the same size in reflection as the Intrepid descent stage, which it isn't, quite a lot smaller. This is supposedly the crater that we looked at earlier, but in fact the view of it would be over there. So they can't even get their models set up properly. These are the footprints of the astronauts, we're told. You can tell I'm not particularly persuaded by their argument. Which happen to be about as wide as the lander. But if you're making footprints, even if you're wearing big boots, which the astronauts were, they're only going to be about 6 inches wide, maybe 12 inches long. So, how come you can make all these wonderful marks there? I'll tell you how you do it. Use Photoshop. That's how it's done. But has somebody has actually taken one of these pictures and gone back to the, from a technical point of view, the RGB figures, red, green, blue, even though this isn't in colour, and then identified the amount of light. The whole thing was photoshopped. This isn't. This was taken in M66 as the Copernicus crater, which is earlier, right, more or less in the centre of the moon. This is a very good photograph taken by an unmanned craft. You can see that they could quite easily use unmanned craft to take very, very good pictures. It's about 60 miles across, in front here, across there. I share this because everybody says, well, the moon's got covered in impact craters. Yes, there are impact craters on the moon. This isn't one of them. An impact crater, by definition, is an impact of a fast-moving object, which will leave a particular bowl-shaped crater. A lump of rock travelling at speed from the sun to here, impacting the moon, will leave a crater that is 8 times as wide as it is deep. So it's 8 miles wide, it'll be about a mile deep. This is 2 miles deep and 60 miles wide, and it's got a flat floor. We've got an impact crater here on Earth, it's called Meteor Crater in Arizona, and it looks exactly like you expect it to look.
You have pictures of the moon and find them, plenty of other impact craters, relatively small, but not this big. This is more likely to be an electrical discharge crater. If you get two electrically charged bodies of different potential moving relatively close to each other, the higher potential will discharge into the lower potential. Mars will discharge into the moon, for instance. And the stories, the historical stories of thunderbolts in the sky, would bear out the fact that people did actually see these things going on. First, Copernicus crater. And here we have Vitello crater, which is the one at the bottom left-hand corner of the moon. This is again taken with an unmanned craft, 1966. Lunar Orbiter 5, not to be confused with Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. So what is this? It's an object with some sort of track leading up to it. Another one here, an object with a track which comes up out of the crater, impacts across the surface of the moon, and is sat here. I don't know what it is. When NASA was asked to explain this, they said, oh, these are rocks dislodged by moonquakes. I didn't even know that the moon was as volcanically active as that, but wouldn't have selectively volcanically active, because it hasn't moved these rocks, or these ones, or these. These are the only two rocks it's moved. I don't know what they are. I'm sure you can fill in the blanks. But it's a mystery. And you'd hope that somebody might have gone back and photographed it in a little more detail, or even landed somewhere. It's quite easy to land on it. Okay. Let's get back to Earth. This is the photograph you'll see more often than any other photograph on Earth from space. You can always tell what it is. It's the little one with the triangle of light over the South Sudan. It's a very good picture, allegedly taken on the Apollo 17 on their return. But if you're going to return from the moon, this is how you're going to come back in your command module. You'll jettison everything else, and you'll come back in your command module at 25,000 miles an hour, very, very fast indeed. And you'll only start heating up your heat shield, which is the third item you need to go to and from the moon. You need a big rocket, you need your spacecraft to travel in, and you need a heat shield to stop it blowing up and burning into pieces. Because the temperature here is about 4,000 degrees Fahrenheit. So there's only one metal I know of that won't melt at that temperature, and that's tungsten, which melts at about 6,000 degrees Fahrenheit. But the command module is made of aluminium. How come that hasn't melted or been damaged? Because it hasn't. That's the Apollo 10 command module in the Science Museum. It looks pretty undamaged to me. It's got handles on the side, obviously it can burn off. Aluminium melts at 1220 degrees Fahrenheit. This is the Orion command module. The Orion module is supposed to replace the Apollo, well, not replace, coming to do the same job. It's going to take men to deep space, to Mars, to land on an asteroid. They always avoid saying, go back to the moon. They never say that. We're going to go to Mars in Orion. We're going to land on an asteroid, as we saw the Brits do it, and we want to do it. But look at their command module, which was fired on the 4th of December last year. On its first test flight, it was flown to about 5,000 miles above the Earth's surface, not very far away, and then it was returned, then it came back to Earth to land in the Pacific. So why did it need space shuttle heat shield tiles on the side of it? There's the heat shield underneath. It needed to have these heat shield tiles installed to stop it burning up. Why wouldn't they put on Apollo? Because Apollo was chucked out of the back of an aircraft. It didn't need to have great heat
light into the atmosphere. The atmosphere on Earth starts at about 80 miles above the surface. Above that is space. There's nothing. 80 miles, you start getting the atmosphere, and the faster you come into it, the more friction there is, the more pressure is being exerted by the heat shield here, and when you use a bicycle pump, it starts getting hot. Same principle, but much more so in space. This is one of the first and a major definitive giveaways that Apollo was completely faked, because the command module would have burned to a crisp. Absolutely no way that went to the moon and came back at 25,000 miles an hour and slowed down on 25,000 miles an hour to 20 miles an hour when the parachute's open. They had to come in, they're told, at a very specific angle, 6.5 degrees. If it comes in any faster, it will just burn up. If it comes in any shallower, it will be what's called a skip entry and bounce off the surface, land again. It won't go into orbit around the sun, it's not going fast enough. It can't escape ice gravity. But it will slow down and eventually go straight through the atmosphere and crash. So this is possibly the most interesting giveaway, and that's only been in the last few months. The rocket that launched this was called the Delta IV, and that was they were liquid fuel, and a central rocket which took the thing up into space, and it was powered by Russian engines.